Hey, it's Kevin Bay. This is Chasing the Yield, December 13th, 2021, episode number 33. Magic number. 33. So let's see what's happening in the world today. I think the market opened up down. I should have had the tab open already, but I didn't. So let me take a look. Let's see. Alrighty. Yeah, so it's down this morning. The Dow Jones has dropped 0.62%, down a couple hundred points. The S&P is down 0.34%. NASDAQ down 0.14%. So things are down. And according to the Wall Street Journal, which I don't think anybody really knows why things go up and go down, because this morning when I opened up the Wall Street Journal, the Dow futures were up, and the headline was futures up ahead of Fed decision, as if the I guess on Wednesday the Federal Reserve was supposed to make some kind of announcement, and in anticipation of the announcement, whatever that announcement's going to be, the stocks were opening up. And then as things got closer to the market open, things went down, and then they changed the headline to stocks open lower ahead of Fed decision. So who the hell knows why things go up and why things go down? I really don't think anybody knows. Sorry, that's my morning coffee. So, other things that are happening in the news today having to do with financial news and business is that hospitals are dropping COVID-19 vaccine mandates in order to ease labor shortages. So, I guess the judge that had put a stop to the Biden administration's mandate, which I don't think there was an actual mandate. I know OSHA was putting out some regulations, but I don't think there was ever an actual presidential, now I'm having a brain fart of what they're called, executive orders, there you go. So I don't think there was an actual executive order. I think there was just kind of a nudge from the Biden administration for OSHA to regulate, and then OSHA put out their rules that they were going to enforce these things, and then subsequently, they dropped all of that. But in the journal, they're reporting that hospital operators, including HCA Healthcare, Tenet Healthcare, as well as nonprofits, Advent Health, and the Cleveland Clinic, are dropping mandates. These are vaccine mandates. Labor costs in the industry have soared. Hospitals struggle to retain enough nurses, technicians, and even janitors to handle higher hospitalizations in recent months as the dreaded Delta variant. They didn't use the word dreaded. I did. Delta variant raged. The vaccine mandates have been a factor constraining the supply of healthcare workers, according to hospital executives, public health authorities, and nursing groups. Many hospitals already struggled to find workers, including nurses, before the pandemic. The shortages were compounded by burnout among many medical workers and the lure of high pay rates offered to nurses who travel to hotspots on short-term contracts. And actually, we have my wife has a friend who has an acquaintance that is doing just that, taking up being a traveling nurse because of the amount of money that they pay. And they don't even have to travel very far, which is kind of funny. They pretty much stay close to home, but are traveling. And in supply chain news, there's a company, Central Freight Lines. This company is almost 100 years old, founded in 1925. It says here they went through several ownership changes and was acquired by somebody in the late 90s. They will be ceasing operation in the midst of what is, all this news around trucking being in high demand and truckers making, a lot of money or in getting bonuses even to get into the game. Meanwhile, this trucking company, they're based out of Waco, Texas, and privately held. They're not public. They're going out of business. They're stopping. The privately held company based in Waco has about 1,200 trucks and is a large operator in the less-than-truckload business, a slice of the trucking sector in which carriers move shipments from multiple customers on a single trailer. Most operators in that business have thrived over the past 2 years under heavy demand from retailers and manufacturers and the pandemic-driven boom in online shopping. Central Freight Lines generated $262 million in revenue in its most recent fiscal year, company president Bruce Kalem said. Despite a significant influx of cash from its owner and chief executives, Swift Transport Company founder Jerry Moyes, the business incurred a loss of $67 million last year. In the latest in a string of losses that totaled roughly $250 million in past years. So that's kind of odd news that a trucking company in this climate where trucks are in such high demand and drivers are in such high demand would be in such bad shape that they went out of business. And it's almost a 100-year-old company. Now, in the story, as I'm reading it, they didn't really say, other than the fact that they're losing money, why they're losing money. But they said that they plan on stopping picking up freight on Monday and will no longer deliver freight by the end of the week or early next week. And a business that I used to be in a couple decades ago, import, export, and wholesale distribution, we use these LTL truckers all the time. It was kind of vital for us to get our stuff from Illinois to places like California and New York and Florida, where we had major distributors. So with one dropping out, that's going to raise prices across the board, I would think, for other LTL carriers. It says it's the largest trucking failure since truckload carrier Celadon Group filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection at the end of 2019. The same year that regional less-than-truckload company New England Motor Freight shut down. So that's weird. I find it weird news today when we're talking about supply chain interruptions and supply chain problems that a major LTL trucking line would go out of business. Inflation is just won't seem to back off and go away. Since it started reporting that it was above 5% earlier in the year. So for the month of November, inflation reached the nearly four-decade high, which is weird. That, and it's still, to me, it's a little bit on the low side because I remember when it was way higher than this, but the Labor Department said the Consumer Price Index, which measures what consumers pay for goods and services, rose 6.8% in November from the same month a year ago. That was the fastest pace since 1982 and the sixth straight month in which inflation topped 5%. The so-called Core Price Index, which I always thought CPI was Consumer Price Index, but I don't know. So maybe there's two different CPIs and I don't know which one I'm talking about. The so-called core price index, which excludes the often volatile categories of food and energy, climbed 4.9% in November from a year earlier. That was a sharper increase than October's 4.6% rise and the highest rate since 1991. The increase in prices for new vehicles, which came in at 11.1% in November, was the largest on record, as were those for men's apparel and living room, kitchen, and dining room furniture. 7.9% surge in fast food restaurant prices last month sparked the sharpest on record too, which, by the way, I can confirm because I ate McDonald's for the first time in, almost a year. And we had two meals, burger, fries, and a drink. And it was like $18, almost $20 for McDonald's. $20. It wasn't all that long ago. It was like $12 for something like that. This is not good. The steady rise in restaurant prices during the past few months is a sign of pass-through from wages into higher prices, which, do you remember when they said that a higher minimum wage would not lead to higher prices. Well, this is proof here that, you know, wages are an expense to a business, and when expenses go up, they have to pass that on to their customer. There's just no other way around it. There's no magic that just makes price wages rise, and there's no consequences on the other side. So let me reread that. The steady rise in restaurant prices during the past few months is a sign of pass-through from wages into higher prices. Economists say, and now they're saying, the dynamic is increasingly showing up in other industries. Wages tracked by the Atlanta Fed climbed 4.3% in November, up from 4.1% in October, the highest since 2007. So again, you know, anybody who, any politician who tells you that higher wages don't lead to higher prices has either never run a business or is lying to you. You know, it, you just think about it logically. Don't think about it as an employee. You know, everybody wants to make more money, but think about it from the, you know, perspective of an employer. How about that? Where you have a certain amount of income and you have a certain amount of expenses and you want to profit. You know, business isn't in business to just provide the good or service. You know, they need to profit, and the profits, you know, have to go to the people who own the company. You know, now this applies across the board, whether it's a small mom and pop store, restaurant, or other business, or if it's a giant multinational corporation that's owned by the public. You know, it's just on a different scale. And that's not to say that some businesses can't afford to pay, you know, their employees higher prices, or I'm sorry, higher wages. You know, but you have to think of what is the purpose of a company. You know, companies are free to do what they want. So, you know, their first and foremost is to stay in business. And their second is to profit and pass those profits on to the owners. So when expenses rise, whether it's energy, whether it's in raw materials, whether it's in wages, regardless of whatever the expenses, when those go up, prices to their customers have to go up. There's just no two ways about it. And we're seeing that right now. So talking about inflation, there's another story in the Wall Street Journal about how people feel about inflation will help answer or help determine whether or not it sticks around. So, you know, it's kind of like a vicious cycle where if you think prices are going to rise, they're going to continue to rise. And this is showing up. Now, I don't think this is quite right, because the current level of inflation, or at least this current spike that we've experienced over the past year, is driven by COVID-19 government policies. Now, when the U.S. government shut down the economy, basically, you know, and it had a ripple effect all across the world, you know, other countries in Europe and everywhere else started shutting down as well. So when you shut these things down, and you shut down factories and you shut down, you know, manufacturing and retail and service industries, it has an enormous ripple effect, especially since, you know, we're in a global economy where the microphone that I'm talking off of has parts, you know, probably from all over the world. You know, the computer, the, you know, all of this stuff is all interrelated. Or even, you know, the McDonald's that we bought yesterday, you know, where's the paper made for the packaging? You know, where does the flour come from for the bun, where the seeds, the sesame seeds? You know, think of all the ingredients. They all come from somewhere. So when all of that stuff was shut down and we're putting restrictions on the number of employees you can have, you know, whether it's a hard count of, you know, because you can only have so many people in a certain space when they're talking about social distancing and those kind of regulations. You know, and you can only have so many customers in a store. you know, things are relaxing now, which is good, but still, you got this giant ripple effect, and people still have not totally gone back to work. We're not up to the same level of employment that we were prior to COVID lockdowns. So this is not really inflation created naturally. This was created out of government fiat. So how quickly we come down from this, I don't know if it has to do with consumer expectations or expectations of economists. I think it just has to do with when do they stop locking everybody down? You know, when do they stop pumping people full of fear about COVID? Because people who are afraid are not going back to work. You know, so the psychology around inflation. And, you know, right now, because there's a shortage of workers, so you have a lot of employers competing for workers, and you have a lot of government money that's been pumped into the system where people don't necessarily have to go back to work. So you've got government competing with private industry for bodies. If you're paying people to stay home, you know, if you're paying them enough to survive, you know, they may not want to go back to work. So those higher wages that people are competing for are, you know, helping to create the inflation that we're experiencing today. So in this, it's a really long Wall Street Journal article, and it goes through, you know, economist expectations and how, you know, how they manipulate the economy and prices and the rate of inflation and interest rates, you know, to try to control levels of employment. And, you know, it's really a complex thing of how they screw with us here. But in the story here, they talk about, let's see, the Fed changed its framework in part because of the natural rate of employment, which had been key to how the Fed judged inflation risks, had proven too difficult to pin down, causing errors such as raising rates too much in 2017 to 2018. So this is still in effect from the Great Recession back in 2008, when they started the quantitative easing and pumping tons of money back into the system. And the Fed actually buying up a lot of the debt themselves. So I think I'm saying that correctly. Back to the story. Inflation expectations, however, are similarly difficult to pin down, which raises two big risks. The first is that the Fed is right and that high inflation will recede on its own, but raises rates anyway out of fear of rising expectations, slowing the economy to head off a non-existent threat. The second is that the Fed has been too optimistic about prices cooling on their own and fails to realize expectations have come unanchored, unleashing a wage price spiral. In this scenario, the Fed would belatedly slam on the brakes and bring inflation down by causing a recession. The Fed is hoping to strike a narrow path between those two risks by ending its bond-buying stimulus program by March, giving it the flexibility to raise rates a few times next year while awaiting evidence on how quickly goods prices reverse direction. I don't know. I still think the current inflation is, as they love to say, transitory. I think it's going to last in through next year. And I think it's all going to be tied to COVID-19 policies. Whether or not things are going to loosen up with travel, things are going to loosen up with employment, is going to come down to when they stop pumping people full of fear with COVID and start relaxing stuff and get rid of these. I don't know what that noise is. I think my wife is doing something downstairs, but it's crazy loud. Anyway, I think it's just going to be tied to government policy. So hopefully it eases, because gasoline here in the Atlanta, Georgia area is like a little over a dollar more than it was a year ago, and it's not fun. Filling up the tank costs so much money. There's another story, why U.S. job gains are so hard to count during COVID-19. It says the pandemic has added uncertainties. Congress sent households trillions of dollars in stimulus payments, and enhanced unemployment benefits, forecasters were caught off guard by how quickly consumers spent that money. Imagine that. Forecasters had no idea that people who were out of work were sent money and then spent it. Much of it, going back to the story, much of it on goods. Economists also struggled to ascertain how quickly businesses would reopen and consumers would return to restaurants and stores. This summer's Delta variant added uncertainty about whether employers would cut jobs. Again, this is not, you know, the story is taking government policy kind of out of the equation here. I think people are done. I think people are pretty much done with the COVID scare. But they, you know, most people just want to follow the rules and get along. And as long as government keeps putting these restrictions down, everything's going to take forever to crawl out of this. This sort of feels like the stagflation of the 1970s, the late 1970s, when everything just felt like crap. And, you know, back then, you know, there was the energy crunch, and I'm too young to really know the sentiment of the time. You know, I was, you know, a preteen back in those days. So, you know, I knew of it and I knew what it felt like sort of, but I didn't, you know, pay attention to the news obviously back then. I really didn't care. And Hoge LNG Partners, moving on from inflation, they received an unsolicited buyout offer from Hoge LNG Holdings. So according to their website, they had a press release. They said, Hoge LNG Partners LP announced today that the board of directors of the partnership received an unsolicited non-binding proposal dated December 3rd from Hoge LNG Holdings Limited, pursuant to which Hoge LNG would acquire through a wholly owned subsidiary all publicly held common units of the partnership in exchange for $4.25 in cash per common unit. So what I did in response to that, because I was holding it, that was the one that they cut their dividend by like 99%. And then subsequently the share price just went into the toilet and dropped by about 70% in the end. 65-70%. And I've been holding it just to see where things were going to go, because I already lost so much principal value from it, so that I didn't see any harm in just kind of hanging on to it. And then with this announcement, coming through, it's non-binding. I don't know if it's going to go through, but I figure, you know what, at this point, I needed to take some losses anyway to mitigate some gains, so I will just do that, or I did that last week, and I picked up shares of, let me find it here. I picked up shares of Office Properties Income Trust. So I took the money that I had left from that, is around $5,000 or so, and I picked up 218 shares of Office Properties Income Trust. They've got a dividend yield of 92.9%, market cap of $1.17 billion. Their stock price today is down 1.6%. It's $23.69. But at least I'll get an annual income out of that, at least for now, of $479 roughly. And they are rated as borderline safe by Simply Safe Dividends. And it seems to be okay. They're a REIT. They're focused on owning and operating leasing properties primarily to single tenants and those with high credit quality characteristics such as government entities. I just needed to swap that out and then get back on some income, because I was getting like $50, I think, out of Hoge LNG Partners. So it was just time to cut those losses and move on. And then the Wall Street Journal had an article about tax loss harvesting, which is, I guess, what I just did with Hoge LNG Partners. Let's see. So they say, our first interesting finding is that conservatively, investors can juice their returns 1.1 percentage points a year on average, assuming a 25% tax rate. if investors are pushing it in terms of taking advantage of every tax loss harvesting opportunity. They can add as much as 1.42 percentage points a year to their portfolio's return. Not surprisingly, investors can recap most from tax loss harvesting when the stock market is having a down year. During years when the S&P 500 yielded a negative return, we estimate that the average benefits of harvesting losses amounted to 3.21 percentage points of additional return to one's equity portfolio, assuming a 25% tax rate. Now, I can't honestly say that I fully understand what the heck that means or how tax loss harvesting can add to your portfolio's return. You know, I guess in tax mitigation, because I'll tell you how I went about mine is that I had a gain because I was, you know, I'm entering the third year of doing what I'm doing with dividend investing, dividend income investing. And so I had to move some things around because I'm still learning and, you know, I was going to take some obvious tax hits on some gains, you know, because I took some risks that I shouldn't have taken and I was a little conservative on some other ones. And so I was selling some stock and buying other stocks to try to rebalance things and get to some kind of consistent level of return and stability in my portfolios. So, you know, I've got episodes on all of that that you can go back and find and listen to as I try to think through it. So I had about, I think, around $6,000 in gain that I would have to pay tax on. So, and that's not, you know, I'm still learning too how all this will affect me. Plus I have, I think it's somewhere around 50, I have to do the total calculations, but somewhere around $50,000 in dividend income, dividend and distribution income from the investments. And since I was, you know, going to dump this one anyway, that would mitigate the taxes that I would have to pay on both the capital gain side, and it should aid in losses that would help mitigate taxes on the dividend income side. So I'll find out when I do my taxes after the first of the year, get all my K-1s in and all the 1099s and figure that out. Okay, update on the portfolios. Last week was a good week. Didn't open up well this week, but last week my low yield portfolio was, let's see, that one's up 2.54%. For the month, it's up 1.98%, and for the year, it's up 18.33%. The medium yield portfolio was up 2.09%, sorry, for the week, 1.84% for the month, and up 11.29% for the year. My high yield portfolio was up 1.19% for the month, for the week, down 2.02% for the month, and down 9.68% for the year. Dividend payments received last week, J&J paid me out $64.66. ADM, Archer Daniels Midland, $65.49. Sorry about that. IBM paid out $100.04. Sunoco Products paid $63.90. In dividend events last week, C.H. Robinson announced their next dividend of 55 cents per share, a 7.8% increase over the previous payout of 51 cents. W.P. Carey, their next dividend of $1.05 per share. That is a 0.29% increase over their previous payout of $1.05 per share. The next three are in line with their previous payouts. Eversource and their next dividend of 60¼ cents per share. Microsoft, their next dividend of 62 cents per share. And Pembina Pipeline, their next dividend of 21 Canadian cents per share. As a reminder, you can donate to this podcast. If you get anything out of this, you're following the portfolios. You can make lump sum donations. You can make tiny subscriptions if you feel like anything you feel that this is worth. You can go ahead and send that off. This is a value for value podcast. And so that means that if you are listening to this on a podcasting 2.0 compatible app, then you can stream Bitcoin or fractions of a Bitcoin called Satoshis to this podcast or any other podcast that is value for value enabled. It's a podcasting 2.0 compatible podcast. It means if you're listening on a podcasting 2.0 compatible app, you'll have access to transcripts, chapters, chapter images that accompany each episode. You can go to newpodcastapps.com and download and support some independent apps that are have. There's even cross app commenting now. So, and it's, I guess, live. I'm not exactly sure. I have to go back and look at the podcasting 2.0 website, podcastindex.org, where they're implementing sort of like live chat, I guess, sort of like, you know, like what YouTube does. There's also, I forget what they call it on YouTube because I stopped doing YouTube a little while back, but in the chat, you can sort of send like a boost payment to the person on YouTube and get a comment out there that they'll read on the air if you pay a certain amount of money. Well, Podcasting 2.0 has also implemented something called a Boostagram, where you can boost the podcaster a certain number of Satoshis and include a note within that boost. So if it's a criticism or some comment that you want read on the air or anything, really, you know, you send that Boostagram and it sends a message along with the payment. So I'm sure, you know, podcasters would be more than willing to read those messages with a little bit of Satoshi love inserted with the boost. ChasingTheYield.com, the website, and myself, Kevin Bay. I'm not a registered investment advisor, broker, or dealer. I may have positions in any financial instrument, product, or company mentioned on the website or the podcast. Information provided on the website or the podcast are provided for information and entertainment purposes only and are not intended as advice or recommendation or an offer or solicitation for the purchase or sale of any security or financial instrument. All opinions are based upon sources believed to be true. I'm sorry, believed to be accurate and are provided in good faith. No warranty, representation, or guarantee expressed or implied is made to the accuracy of the information contained herein. Please contact an investment professional if you have any questions regarding an investment. And if you need to contact me, you can reach me at mail@chasingtheyield.com. And there are also links to Twitter and Facebook over there. That is it for this week. We're getting close to Christmas time. What are we, 12 days away now? 12 days of Christmas. Sing the song. You know you want to. But that is all I've got for this week, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.